Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Giles Snyder. This week we check in with our friends and neighbors across the region, many of whom are hunkering down at home, helping to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus. We'll hear stories about people reaching out to lend a helping hand, like helping a stranger at the grocery store.
The lady next to me said, "You know what? I'll purchase two of your bread items on my tab because you have children and now your family will have enough bread that they need."
Clara Lehman lives in Helvetia, West Virginia. She says people in her community are resilient, but daily life has changed overnight.
I think that everybody is kind of needing right now is the mundane. Like, we all want normal.
And we'll talk with Chuck Reese, the host of a podcast that takes an unflinching look at Appalachians and the role community often plays in daily life.
The media stereotype says that the Appalachian is a loner. Well, you go find me a bunch of people who will more fiercely defend their small community than people in the Appalachian Mountains.
We'll hear these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Giles Snyder. You may mark the beginning of the spring season the same way I do, when the daffodils come up. My wife's daffodils are in full bloom right now, and I'm always pleased to see them, even if they're also a reminder that I'll soon be back behind the lawnmower. Cutting grass may not be among my favorite things to do, but like the daffodils, yard work is part of the renewal process. This year, though, the transition to spring is different. Many of us remain cooped up inside as if it's still winter for fear of spreading the coronavirus. Usually this time of year marks the start of festival season. Seems like just about every little community throughout the region celebrates springtime in its own way. Take Ramp Suppers, for instance. And just down the road from my house in the upper Shenandoah Valley, there's the Apple Blossom Festival in Winchester, Virginia. This year, though, everything is pretty much on pause while we hold our collective breath and wait for the spread of the coronavirus to slow. Appalachia already struggles in many ways, but you can also look at it this way. The region could be uniquely positioned for what comes next, how we rebuild. After all, people in Appalachia are nothing if not resilient, and there are people here who've been working for years to improve the region's fortunes. Conversations around Appalachia's economy center around the question, can we encourage more industries to flourish here, or must we rely solely on coal for the future? And as we wrestle with our current economic struggles and joblessness, how can we build a better foundation moving forward so we aren't as vulnerable to economic collapse? We'll have more on that later. We're actually going to begin with a break from news about the coronavirus and laugh along with a really funny and thoughtful podcast that's often about Appalachia. Yeah, I know, you're welcome. The podcast I'm talking about is an offshoot of an online magazine called The Bitter Southerner. It's devoted to the culture of the South, and over the last 2 years, the magazine expanded to produce the podcast with support of Georgia Public Broadcasting. One episode featured conversations with writers of a book published as a counterpoint to J.D. Vance's controversial memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. It's called Appalachian Reckoning, A Region Responds to Hillbilly Elegy. Here's an excerpt from that show featuring the podcast host, Chuck Reese.
In the months when Hillbilly Elegy sat firmly atop all the bestseller lists, conversations began among many native Appalachians and among some academics who were fascinated by the region even though they didn't grow up there. Two of these people were Meredith McCarroll, a North Carolina mountain woman who is now the director of the Writing and Rhetoric Program at Bowdoin College in Maine, and Anthony Harkins, a non-Appalachian steeped deeply in the region through his work as a history professor at Western Kentucky University. And their conversations led them to assemble a book called Appalachian Reckoning, A Region Responds to Hillbilly Elegy. Appalachian Reckoning includes 40 voices: white, Puerto Rican, black, queer, straight, trans, activists, teachers, preachers, artists, sociologists, historians, legal scholars, literary scholars, and organizers. About half of them are women, and every damn one of them is Appalachian.
As you can see, Reese does not shy away from topics that can be awkward to discuss. Take, for instance, an episode in which he explores how stereotypes are used to crack jokes about Appalachians on a cartoon called Squidbillies. It's an animated show that airs on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, asked Reese to talk about why this cartoon, and maybe even comedy in general, helps us unpack the thorny issue of how the world talks about Appalachia and how we Appalachians talk about ourselves.
One of my favorites that you did, just because I laughed through the whole thing, was your special episode between season one and season two of the podcast about the Squidbilly show.
Yeah, that was so much fun to do.
Oh, I bet. I mean, yeah, you could hear it just listening to it. Yeah, I'm sure you were just laughing the whole time. Let's listen to a clip from the show about the Squidbillies.
If you're unaware, the Cartoon Network has a sort of late-night mini-network called Adult Swim, and Squidbillies is one of Adult Swim's longest-running shows.
The church should be taught in the schools, and the schools should be part of the damn church. Now, you might say, Biggie, hey, you quit schooling in the second grade. That's right.
That was the voice of Early Kyler, the granddaddy in a family of what they call anthropomorphic mud squids, who live in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Georgia, exactly where I grew up.
And I know it's not, you didn't create it, so I'm not going to ask you to explain
Lord
that.
Lord have mercy, no.
And it's explained well in the podcast, though. But how do you think, how do they handle those stereotypes? And they hit some of them, some of the rawest, ugliest stereotypes about Appalachia, but they do it in a way that people from Appalachia aren't getting offended. I mean, they've been doing it 15 years. But, I mean, it's funny, but we don't take it personally. And as compared to J.D. Vance and Hillbilly Elegy, I thought
right.
I thought it was interesting. And I don't know if it's just using the humor or if they've got real people doing real accents or what. I don't know. But how do they manage that?
Well, I'm still not sure I know the answer, even though I've spent more than an hour talking to them. You know, I think they've got a particular gift, the two creators of that show, you know, because they take the stereotype and they turn it like all the way up to 11. And it becomes so silly and so surreal that you can't help but, you know, laugh at it. I mean, it's not a show for everybody by any means, but, you know, I mean, it was amazing that night, because we did that here at the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, and we had an audience of maybe 100 people. And I was amazed at how many people showed up who literally had, like, talked about how they had grown up on Squidbillies.
You're from the foothills of Appalachia. You're the southern end of the Appalachian mountain chain. What's different and what's the same about those two regional groups?
I wrote about this in the Appalachian Reckoning episode. You know, all the people of Appalachia essentially came down from ports in the Northeast or in Virginia, right? And over the years, they filtered their way into the mountains. And I think there's an essential difference between the sort of people who would be drawn to a more isolated existence in the mountains, where isolated existences are easy to maintain, than people who were drawn to the hubbub of the cities. You know, the media stereotype says that the Appalachian is a loner. Well, you go find me a bunch of people who will more fiercely defend their small community than people in the Appalachian Mountains. Over the years of doing the Bitter Southerner, as I've gotten to know and had the chance to interview more and more people from farther up in Appalachia, the more I recognize how there's so much cultural commonality from all the way up UR all the way down to Springer Mountain down here. And we all face the same misunderstanding.
That was Chuck Reese, the editor of The Bitter Southerner and the host of the magazine's podcast. He was speaking with Eric Douglas. There's a link on our website where you can hear the full episode about Squidbillies, which features some of the voices behind the Cartoon Network show. As the ongoing economic fallout from the coronavirus reshapes lives, small-town business owners are worried about the future. Reporter Sydney Bowles takes us to Whitesburg, Kentucky, where a town already struggling from the decline in the coal industry grapples with a new challenge.
Whitesburg has been dealt a tough hand. The Appalachian Regional Commission considers Letcher County, where Whitesburg is located, to be distressed because of its high unemployment, high poverty rate, and low per capita income. But Whitesburg is a fabulous little town. I know because I live there. It's got lots of public art, there's a great walking trail along the river, and it's full of people who are passionate about building a diverse and sustainable community after coal. All of that's to say, Whitesburg is fragile, and the economic fallout from the coronavirus is likely to destabilize this place and places like it harder and faster than in larger cities. One thing that's already having an impact is the ban on dine-in services at restaurants.
Heritage Kitchen.
Amber Bailey is a server at Heritage Kitchen, a restaurant in downtown Whitesburg. She makes her money on tips, and that means her income has nosedived.
I'm one of the lucky ones. Like, my boyfriend works, has a, you know, a full-time job. But I have a lot of friends who work in the restaurant industry. They're servers and bartenders, and they don't have anybody else. So I'm more worried for them than I am for myself.
Brad Shepard owns Heritage.
Our primary business that we make money from is dine-in customers. We've always done some level of delivery and takeout, and that's all mostly supplemental income to the dine-in.
Shepard plans to stay open for takeout and delivery for 1 month and then reevaluate. But he's worried if the crisis goes on for longer than that, he'll have to shut down. Just like Amber Bailey, Shepard isn't just worried for himself.
It takes all of us to really keep a vibrant downtown going. So losing anyone downtown permanently would be a devastating blow.
You know, I don't foresee every business making it through this. There's just no way.
That's Allison Davis, Executive Director of the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky at the University of Kentucky. Her organization has helped rural coal-reliant communities transition away from fossil fuels, as well as prepare for crises like natural disasters.
When we've talked with communities in the past about being resilient to disaster, this is not the type of disaster that we've tried to prepare communities for.
No one can say how long this crisis will last or how intense the suffering will be. Still, Davis says, rural communities have real strengths that can help them weather the hard times.
It is the local people right now that are determining their chance of success post this disease. And so I get excited because I know some of these communities, they have really rallied. And this is not like, oh, we should start getting together. It is, we have been together. We know each other. We know our strengths. We know our informal and formal leaders. Like, we're going to figure something out.
Back at Heritage Kitchen, server Amber Bailey is already thinking about how to support her community.
I posted last night on Facebook, if we end up shutting our doors here, then I can help some of my other friends who may have little ones where their daycares are gone.
Bailey still has hours, and she still knows exactly how I like my burger when I call to order takeout. But projections show unemployment in rural Kentucky is already skyrocketing, and it's only going to get worse. Across the street, downtown pub Streetside has laid off its servers indefinitely. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Of course, any conversation about Appalachia's economic future is largely overshadowed at the moment by fears of a global recession caused by the coronavirus pandemic. How we reshape our economic future largely rests in how the country as a whole moves forward to help get millions of people back to work. Becca Schimmel is a reporter with the Ohio Valley Resource. For the past 4 years, she's been covering Appalachia's changing economic landscape. The region already struggles with some of the highest rates of unemployment in the nation. Add to that the fallout from the coronavirus outbreak. Becca, thanks for talking with me.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Now, we've heard a lot about workers being laid off since stay-at-home orders have been issued, and businesses have been asked to remain closed for the time being. And you've kept tabs on the situation in the Ohio Valley. What are people worried about?
Well, people are worried about evictions. Do they have enough food? What are they going to do when rent comes around? Especially because we have a lot of people who work in the service industry. And so they depend on those customers coming in. They depend on that living paycheck to paycheck kind of lifestyle for a lot of people. And so having these shut down, even if places are still open for takeout, that still is a big decrease in revenue and in tips and things like that. So they're worried about, am I going to be able to afford rent? How long is this going to go on? And what should I do in the meantime? They're being encouraged to apply for unemployment, but for some people in the region, that's not really an option, like those who work in the gig economy or those who are hairdressers, contractors, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've read some of your reporting. You visited a restaurant in Ohio, and you've spoken with some auto workers in Kentucky. Could you give me a sense of who these people are?
Yeah, so I spoke to somebody in Ohio who had been working at this restaurant where 11 people got laid off because of restaurants closing, and that was in Albany, Ohio, I believe. And there was just a sense of a change in life, not only an effect on their pocketbook or the money that they're going to be earning, but it was a sense that this is part of their community. And that they would miss the people that they regularly speak to and serve and help. And that was a lot of the feeling that I got from the food service industry when I've talked to different people working in restaurants is that, you know, this is my daily life. What do I do now? And it's a lot of times people who are used to interacting with the public a lot more. And it's something that for some people, they really enjoy doing. And so it's been a hard transition in that sense. And as far as the automotive industry is concerned, they're still only looking at kind of a short-term shutdown so that they can clean the facilities. But what I got from the United Auto Workers is that they're not sure they can actually adequately clean these facilities and get to everything, or that it'll really help and they'll be able to come back within the time frame that they've been given.
Mm-hmm. The latest economic rescue package Congress considered this week aims to address many of the questions that workers have about their immediate future. I'm talking about expanded unemployment benefits and making money available to small businesses to help them meet payroll. Now, you've spoken to some economists on the ground in your region, and what are they suggesting?
Yeah, they're suggesting that, you know, we need some of those things that already are in that package. Expanded unemployment, paid sick leave, increased access to Medicaid, social safety net programs. And some of the economists that I've talked to, particularly an economist in Kentucky, is saying that we need some kind of short-term universal base income where we're not just seeing these one-time checks for people, but that it's something that is there on a consistent basis until the economy and the country can come out of this pandemic and be able to open places back up and business gets back to normal.
Mm-hmm. How are regional leaders responding?
Well, a little bit differently. Kentucky and Ohio have been similar. I think it's been Ohio first with some of these restrictions or precautions, then Kentucky, and then West Virginia kind of following third in line of those three states. Bars and restaurants are closed. Front-facing businesses are closed. Anywhere really that people can gather or have the potential to gather, those places have largely been closed down and shuttered in most of the region.
I don't want to be insensitive, but economic hardship is nothing new to Appalachia. I wonder if you get a sense that people in the region are somehow better equipped, if you will, to deal with this, or is there more of a sense of resignation about, you know, just one more thing to deal with?
It's definitely different across the region, I think. For some people, they're kind of already, in a sense, hardened to these experiences where, you know, the coal industry has left, as well as other businesses or those that had the potential to get started and really bring a lot of jobs haven't happened. And so it's unfortunate that there's, in some places in Appalachia, this expectation of hardship and this resiliency to it. And in other places in the Ohio Valley, there's the kind of attitude of, well, now this is another thing that I'm dealing with. And that shock is still there. So it varies across the region a little bit.
Yeah, job losses, economic uncertainty, always tough things to cover, especially now. Do you ever get used to it, or is this something you just have to compartmentalize when you get home at night?
I would say some days I'm used to it, and that's really when I've been working on one particular piece for a while, and that really just means I'm used to a very small portion of it for a short amount of time. And I think that the thing that does help is there are people across the region that are looking for solutions, that are opening their businesses, that are supporting each other in their community. And while Appalachia has faced a lot of hardship, it also is a very strong community. The kind of community that even those that have left the region still feel a part of. So I think that's something that I kind of hold on to and take home with me as well.
Well, Becca, take care of yourself, okay?
Thanks, you too.
Up next, as the world grapples with COVID-19, how artisans and farmers are responding to the coronavirus crisis.
Right now, I keep trying to stay focused, trying to make new work, regardless of the fact that that work's going anywhere and may not for a long time.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Giles Snyder. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Next, we're going to explore Appalachia's changing economic landscape and how shifts beyond the region's control affect daily life. No, I'm not talking about coronavirus, so the economic pressures so many people in Appalachia have been facing for decades are now mirrored across the country as millions of people now find themselves suddenly unemployed. How can we bounce back? It's a question on a lot of people's minds. Declines in coal production have led many workers to lose their jobs in communities across the region. Trey Kay hosts a podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting called Us and Them. He's been spending time over the past several months exploring communities along Route 60 in West Virginia. He spoke with people there about how they hope to find new ways forward.
I was recently driving through the Upper Kanawha Valley in southern West Virginia. I was traveling along Route 60, which is part of the Midland Trail. The road runs through West Virginia, and some call it the main street of small towns. It runs along the Kanawha River through thick forests. So much has happened recently. A virus has changed our world, killed people, and created economic uncertainty. As I drove along, I realized I was in a region that's been turned upside down before. It's a place where people find ways to keep going. I rode this way hundreds of times when I was a kid with my parents and grandparents. My brother and I were in the way back of the station wagon. We'd go and visit relatives in small towns along the Upper Kanawha. But this route also led to other relatives who lived farther away, and it was the way we'd go to get to my family's cabin. When I was a kid, I was focused on where we were going, and all these towns seemed like something that you had to go through just to get to our destination. And I confess I really didn't think much about all these towns in this region as they stretch along the Kanawha for miles. But as I look at them today, it dawns on me, in this corridor, civilization hugs the river. And behind these towns and communities, in both directions, there is a whole lot of wilderness. The idea of communities hugging the river seems like a perfect metaphor. For years, the river supported business and industry, coal mines, chemical plants, and natural gas. It provided stability and prosperity. But things have really changed since I was a kid. As the nation's economy has grown, people here along the Kanawha haven't shared in that prosperity. And now they need to make sense of the big unknown around them. I wasn't making this trip through the valley alone. Along for the ride were two local mayors, Ann Cavalier from the city of Smithers and Greg Ingram from Montgomery. Their cities are across the river from each other, but the two mayors have been working together to define a new future for the region.
Okay. And one of the things you need to know about our two towns is we are located on the north and south side of the Kanawha River, and our boundaries actually touch. So we geographically are very, very close together, and we like to call ourselves the two municipalities with one community.
And that's because we all go to the same churches, we kids go to the same schools.
We are.
So we are really one community. The only thing that divides us is the Great Kanawha River.
That's right.
In 2.8 miles, take exit 96 on the right onto US 60 East toward Midland Trail.
As we drove along the river, we passed the old DuPont plant. I thought the chemical industry had completely left the region, but Mayor Cavalier says there still are a few chemical employers.
It is still the DuPont plant. I don't have the exact figures, but the number of employees there is well below what it was in its heyday in the 1950s.
I think they actually changed it to Chemours, didn't they?
I think it's
two separate plants. Okay. I think DuPont left and it's Chemours, and there's one other chemical processor in there, and I'm not sure who it is.
Oh, there on the east end. Yes.
Yes. So the plant has drastically downsized. There's only a small portion of it still operational. What I would like to point out on the other side of the river is where I used to work was Walker Caterpillar. And when coal went away, they primarily went after the gas industry. And if you noticed when we came by, they have probably several hundred hydraulic excavators on their property because they went after the gas business. Well, now the gas business has fallen. And any businessman knows if that equipment's sitting on your lot, it's not out making money. So now the gas industry is taking a hit here in West Virginia. That's the latest part of the tsunami, and we are yet to see the results of that.
When Mayor Ingram talks about a tsunami, he's talking about the economic devastation that hit this region. Both mayors say a number of conditions have left the Upper Kanawha Valley reeling.
If you notice, economic activity stops here. There's a Walmart here. There's nothing from here on up. So as we go on up through the Kanawha Valley, we'll kind of point out and explain to you about the Appalachian Power Plant closure. The skeleton of that building still sits there. So also infrastructure is a big part of whether a small town makes it or not. You know, we had the turnpike that for political reasons back in the 70s, 80s, turned south of Paint Creek and went to Beckley. That's why the college is now in Beckley, because the interstate went there. It was supposed to come through Montgomery, but there was more political power in Beckley than there was in Montgomery. So that's another part of the effect of a downturn in any economy or tsunami effect. But that is a coal processing plant, and the reason there's piles and piles of coal is because the price of coal is down. They have nowhere to sell it. You'll also see as we get closer to Montgomery, the Mammoth Coal Facility also has mountains and mountains of coal. The coal is actually running over the berms. What they call berms is the walls around the coal pile. They have so much coal on top of the ground that they don't have a market to sell it for. That coal, even though they're still mining some coal, there's just no market for it.
So both of us have been involved in the Leadership West Virginia program. And the year that I went through, we were in the northern part of the state, and we went 1,000 feet underground and then traveled 6 miles in coal cars, actually ended up in Pennsylvania. And we got to watch while one man with underground equipment, computerized equipment, was mining as much coal as 100 men would have mined 50 years ago.
Wow.
So one person replaced 50. So the mechanization in the mines cannot be underplayed as part of the downturn in jobs in coal. So you can mine more coal with fewer people, thus you have fewer jobs and less money circulating in the community. What people lost in all of this? Yes, they lost jobs. Yes, they lost money. Yes, they lost concerts and lectures and Friday night football games. But above all else, they lost hope. And when you lose hope, that devastates the person, the family, and the community. People talk about the opioid crisis. In our town, opioids aren't the big problem. It's meth. It's street drugs. All right? And you watch and you see the people, because we know everybody in town. When you see that, you see somebody who was at one point able to feed and clothe and house their family and drive a decent car and go to work every day and feel productive. And when you take that hope away, you take away that person's future.
If your family has lived in this region for generations and you don't want to abandon it, what do? You can lobby coal or chemical companies to come back. You can lobby the government to lend a helping hand. Or disappointment can turn to depression and drugs. Mayor Ann Cavalier suggests another option. Now is the time when people need to pull together and create something new.
And what we're doing is we're working every day, 7 days a week, as many hours a day as it takes, to create the kind of attraction to business and culture and social lives and opportunities so that people do have hope. Because if you give them hope, they can build. They can build their lives, their family lives, and the community.
As we heard, things are bleak in the Upper Kanawha Valley. Big companies and education institutions are gone. I had a lot of questions about this for Kanawha County Commissioner Kent Carper, and he seemed a little irritated with my questions. He asked me, are we going to get on to some of the good news? I mean, he's a young guy, but he's old enough to remember a different time.
The Upper Kanawha Valley at one time was politically powerful. On election night in the largest county in the state, the Upper Kanawha Valley picked who held offices. Not so much today.
Now he's working with Terrell Ellis, an economic development consultant, to jumpstart business development in the region.
We have a competitive tax base as a state, tax rates. Our workforce is, second to none in terms of productivity, and these aren't going to be made up numbers. You know, there is documentation of the productive nature of our workforce and the loyalty of the workforce. And we have a strategic location that can get your products out to market in a rapid way.
They have a plan to turn things around. First, they're doing triage to stop the bleeding and to make sure no other businesses leave. Second, they're making an effort to secure and maintain abandoned buildings, spruce them up a little and make them more appealing to prospective new clients. Third, they're working on attracting new businesses. And finally, they're encouraging West Virginians to start their own businesses. And that requires some effort because, as Ellis says, West Virginia has one of the lowest business startup rates in the nation.
So we have a small business startup program where we provide forgivable loans to new small businesses or businesses that are expanding. And the commission started that. And then we went out and layered on top of that, we got resources to get a business coach to work with those businesses to help them grow their business, work through all the issues that, you know, when you're trying to start up a business, you don't know what you don't know. So the business coach is there to help. And then we layered on top of that additional funding for technical support for the business.
One of their most innovative programs is called the UCAN Grant, spelled U-K-A-N. It stands for Upper Kanawha Loan Grant Program. Their goal is to either support new businesses or help older businesses expand or reinvent themselves. Kanawha County Commission President Kent Carper says local people are involved at every step of the process.
We have an independent committee with business people, very well-known business people, community people who live there. What a novel idea, pick people who actually live there. And they make applications. We notify the applications. It's publicly done. Terrell and our staff at the County Commission look through the applications. Then they meet with this independent committee and vet them. They vet them to see if that makes sense. Understanding that we're more than willing to take a risk on this because you've got to take a risk at this point.
When you have these successful entrepreneurs, if you kind of sow the seeds in a community that has had a downturn, does that make it more appealing to potentially a bigger industry to come in?
Success has many fathers, failure has none. Yes, when one succeeds or the word gets out that they got a grant, it's infectious. You know, the problem is the state and the federal government is always looking for these huge projects, these big wins where they line up on ribbon cutting day and they've got 900 people and they're talking about billions of dollars and game changer, win-win, all these little cliches. But frankly, when you look in the eyes of someone who has one or two employees and just went to three, that's progress in real time. That can be a game changer. Maybe it's small, but small is good.
We've been listening to an excerpt from the latest Us and Them, a podcast our colleagues at West Virginia Public Broadcasting produce. Find it at wvpublic.org. Across the country and the world lately has been tough, and while it's true that some people are panicking and buying up all the toilet paper and hand sanitizer from grocery stores, there are also those who are responding to the stress with compassion and kindness. We asked listeners to share some of the stories they've run across. We heard about several restaurants and chefs that have been handing out free meals, including to children out of school. For example, an Indian restaurant in Charleston, West Virginia's capital, hosted a free lunch. They took to the sidewalk to hand out food to whoever walked up and asked. In the words of the owners of Sitar India, "Our stores are empty, people are scared, and we just want to give back to the community we love." We also heard from Jamie Miller, also in Charleston, who said her son, who's 20 years old, was in the checkout line at Goodwill. A woman in front of him in the line paid for his cart of clothes. She told him to pay it forward. So we went and bought a grocery cart full of cleaning supplies and food and donated them to an apartment building where low-income residents live. We also received this voicemail from Ingrid Hendrickson of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
The other day when I was going to the store, I was in line talking to a nice lady, and during our conversation, I learned that she had grandchildren, and she had heard that I was a mother of four children. And while we were checking out, the store had rationed that you could only take two pieces of bread, and I had purchased four pieces. And I was checking out, the cashier lady explained to me that I could only choose two breads. I mentioned to the lady that I have children, so the manager came down, and the manager said, "Sorry, ma'am, you're going to have to return two items." So then I was sitting there trying to decide, you know, what I should return, and the lady next to me said, you know what, I'll go ahead and purchase two of your bread items. Now your family will have enough bread that they need. So the total bill was $3.75, but it was just a very nice gesture, and, you know, it just made my whole day.
Thanks for your message, Ingrid. Now for my own story of kindness. Twitter is known more for its spats and trolls rather than compassion and empathy. But last weekend, after an NPR newscast I was doing completely blew up in my face, a listener from California tweeted at me out of the blue. She charitably acknowledged the newscast as being a little rough, but said that it was okay because she appreciates what we do. My Twitter friends around public media from NPR and others around the country chimed in with encouragement. If not for that initial tweet, I would have left work that day kicking myself. Instead, I turned up in the newsroom the next day with a renewed sense of purpose. That's my story of kindness, and we still want to hear yours. Email us at insideappalachia@wvpublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook. Search the West Virginia Public Broadcasting page. If you're a regular listener of Inside Appalachia, you may be familiar with our Folkways project. We've been working to tell the story of Appalachia through the lens of folk life traditions, everything from making salt rising bread to handmade furniture and old-time music. For a lot of these artisans, their art or craft provides their primary income, and a lot of them depend on social events like concerts, farmers markets, and craft fairs. So we tapped our Folkways reporter, Caitlin Tan, and asked her to circle back with some of the artists, craftsmen, and local business owners you've heard on the air over the past couple of years, and a few new voices as well, to see how they're doing. She put this together for you.
My name is Clara Lehman, and I live in Helvetia, West Virginia. My family owns the Hutte restaurant.
My name is Kara Vanek, and I'm a small farmer in Weston, West Virginia. I grow small fruits and herbs and make jams, jellies, and herbal teas.
My name is Ginger Dance, and I am a full-time professional artist in Fayetteville, West Virginia.
My name is Eddie Austin. I'm a woodworker and business owner in Hamlin, West Virginia.
My name is Brannon Ritterbush. I am the owner of Wild Art Wonderful Things in Fayetteville, West Virginia.
My name is Kelsey Boyd, and I am the owner and creator for Silver Market Co., located in Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Hello, my name is Shane McManus, and I am a co-founder and member of the Greensboro, Pennsylvania Art Cooperative in Greensboro, Pennsylvania.
My name is Robert Villamagna, and I'm an artist living in Wheeling, West Virginia. This whole coronavirus thing is, I don't know, like everybody else, they probably feel like they're living in the middle of a Twilight Zone episode.
I haven't obviously seen nearly any foot traffic, which is to be expected. And honestly, part of me is super glad for that because it means people are taking this seriously and staying the heck home.
But as far as business goes, I think it's going to be really, really hard on everyone. And I'm not sure how we're going to manage to come out of this. Hopefully, you know, this does give us an opportunity to kind of test run our barter economy, and maybe we'll encourage more people to produce more than they consume. I don't know.
Our wholesale orders have slowed because brick and mortar sales are down, but we are continuing to sell online.
And that brings us into what we're doing to survive the coronavirus. We are making art.
I'm definitely concerned at this point, but not panicking yet. So far, I've been getting a little too obsessive about reading and preparing for everything. So my studio time has been significantly reduced in the last week or two, but I'm hoping to find that equilibrium and get back in the studio producing on a regular basis.
Right now I keep trying to stay focused, trying to make new work, regardless of the fact that that work's going anywhere and may not for a long time. But I'm just keep making it. And I think it's more important now than ever for me to put in studio time.
As far as professionally, things haven't really changed for me. I'm actually quite good at shutting myself in my wood shop and finishing my day. I am worried about business a little bit because I feel like this is maybe time when people aren't going to be spending as much money. But I am hopeful, and we will push through this crisis.
I've already implemented some alternative plans for my income. I've been selling quite a bit more of kombucha as of late, and so I've been currently offering curbside pickup kombucha. People can still support us by purchasing gift cards, for sure, is one awesome way to do that. We are still trying to survive, and this is a scary time for small business owners. I just encourage people to support us how they can, even if that's just being sharing our posts on social media, helping us to stay relevant.
I think for a lot of businesses, we struggle, especially in areas like this, in rural areas, that we're afraid of becoming irrelevant. And being shut down for a month, 2 months is kind of scary for people.
So I have a small farm stand, which is a kind of pay what you can afford farm stand. And I've put some aloe plants out there so people can get those and maybe make their own hand sanitizer.
Put the screwdriver away. I know this is so mundane, but hey, I'll just record everything. Talk to myself. That's one thing I think that everybody is kind of needing right now is the mundane. Like, we all want normal, and our brains are whirling and cloudy, and the mundane is getting a roshti or getting a sauerbraten dinner or fixing a doorknob.
Last week, we started watching Lord of the Rings, the three movies, and Gandalf's words to a terrified Frodo really rang true. And I'm just paraphrasing here, but we don't get to choose the times that we live in, but what's important is how we use the time that we have. So I try to cling to that as a reminder that there are no guarantees and we just have to live in the moment and do the best we can.
My advice for local businesses or artists in West Virginia is to do whatever you can to keep putting one foot forward, to think about the present. What can I do today and not get too discouraged about what tomorrow looks like? I think that people in West Virginia are very resilient. They show a lot of grit, and I think that we'll survive.
There's no more needing population than that of rural Appalachia, so we really hope everyone stays safe out there and stays positive. Make sure that nobody is worried or afraid of their safety, because we are all here to protect and help each other.
Hey, hang in there. And if you're an artist wannabe, go make your work regardless. Just try to find some time in the day to make work and share it with your friends. Okay? All right, have a great day.
I think that's about it. I'm walking through the meadow now, which is where we hold our fair in September. Hopefully this madness will be over by then so that you can come see us folk dance and yodel and sing and all that good stuff. And there's the bells.
Again, those were the voices of artists and local business owners we've interviewed in the past telling us how they're doing in the new world of coronavirus. It was produced by our Folkways reporter, Caitlin Tan, and you can check out our webpage to find the original stories of these artists at wvpublic.org. We're going to wrap up this week's show where we began, with the coronavirus. I live near Shepherdstown in West Virginia's eastern panhandle. Shepherdstown was the first town in the last state in the nation to report a confirmed coronavirus case. I didn't grow up in Shepherdstown, but my dad's family has a long history there. I like to visit from time to time, grab a coffee, and sit outside to people watch, or perhaps peek into the past to see what the Snyders who came before me saw. After Shepherdstown reported its coronavirus case, I decided to head over to see how things were going, and I took our dog Jasper. He's kind of ornery, meaning he habitually gets into things he shouldn't. But he's good with people, and dogs are good conversation starters. I mean, there's always someone around who wants to gush over a dog. Shepherdstown is usually bustling, but except for a guy who had set himself up in a lawn chair in front of Shepherd University's clock tower building, everyone seemed to be remaining indoors. I sat on a bench for a while. A few others turned up now and again, but the main street through town remained largely deserted. On the way back to my car, I passed by the building my great-grandfather built to house the operations of his small-town newspaper, the long-defunct Shepherdstown Register. There's now a taco joint on the first floor, and taped to the door was a sign of the times, informing potential patrons hungry for lunch that it was closed for the time being. I did run into a man and a woman who took one look at my dog Jasper and asked to pet him. Don't worry, we maintained our social distance, but I took the opportunity to ask how they thought Shepherdstown was doing. The man mentioned tumbleweeds and said he's been coming to Shepherdstown for 25 years and that it's never been like this. The woman swept an arm towards a Shepherd University building and noted that students were nowhere to be found. Colleges and universities closed, deserted streets, restaurants, and other businesses in limbo. I've never seen anything like it either. At least dogs are around, though, to keep things from getting too awkward. Till next time, thanks for joining me here inside Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, the Bitter Southerner podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting, Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council. We also had help from the Ohio Valley Resource, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Our theme music is by Matt Jackfert. Other music this week was provided by Dinosaur Burps. Roxy Todd is our producer, Eric Douglas, our associate producer, our executive producer is Glennis Board. She also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens, and Xander Alloy helped put the show together this week. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcast. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu. Thank you.